I think Star Wars was constructed to let people live in it however they wanted.
It has created a template for us to talk about all sorts of stuff that affects politics, culture, and ideas.
It sells this idea that all of this is happening in some larger world, and there was nothing like this out at the time.
What we're talking about, and this is part of the thing that we like to do at Reason, is talk about popular culture not simply as, okay, well, you know, is this movie, is this book, is this record good or bad? But, you know, what's interesting about it? How are people, both the producers, but especially the consumers of something, using it to talk about issues and ideas that are important to them? All culture is participatory culture now more than ever. And Star Wars is kind of a fascinating cultural phenomenon going back now, what, 30 plus years. You know, where in many ways, and, you know, I'm happy to take abuse for this, in many ways it is total crap culture. It was, the first movie was produced by a semi-literate guy who, but it has created a template, and I don't mean that disparagingly, you know, that he was semi-literate. It has created a template and a kind of matrix, a framework, a scaffold for us to talk about all sorts of stuff that affects politics, culture, and ideas. And it's huge. It's absolutely part of the everyday fabric of all we talk about. So it deserves attention for that, well beyond a question of whether or not you think, you know, the particular camera work is interesting or the storytelling is cliched or whatever. It is so important in that way. And so with that as a kind of rambling intro, for each of you, what to you is the core of Star Wars appeal, arguably more than any other cultural phenomena of the past 40 years? Star Wars has captured the public's imagination and the public's pocketbook. We have in our cover story of the latest issue of Reason, which you can pick up for free out in the other room, something like $42 billion of money has been generated out of George Lucas's vision of the first Star Wars movie. Really fascinating. But so, Alyssa, let's start with you. What do you find so special about Star Wars that it's still a thriving enterprise years later?
Well, one of the things I think is fascinating about Star Wars and is that in many ways it sort of anticipates the way that culture is created today. Right now, if you look at the television business model, for example, ratings are down a lot, but a show can survive forever on incredibly passionate viewers. And Star Wars is sort of an early work in a way that really leans into fan enthusiasms, but it's constructed in such a way that there's something there for everyone. You know, if you're looking for a strong female heroine, Princess Leia is sort of the template that pop culture has followed for the next 40 years. If you are interested in sort of big geopolitical issues, you have this fascinating clash between the Empire and the Rebellion. If you're looking for sort of, you know, soft spirit, you know, 70s spirituality, the Force was literally so powerful an idea that Francis Ford Coppola suggested that he and George Lucas found a real-world religion based on it. If you like sort of mannered British humor, you have Anthony Daniels as C-3PO. And so it has all of these different hooks for any, you know, almost any particular taste to find itself represented in the films, in the books, not so much in the three prequels, but we can talk about whether those count later. And so it manages to do all of that without being discordant in a really interesting way. It's a tough act to pull off, that sort of fussy British humor, the big clashes, the coming of age story with Luke Skywalker, the sort of Rick Blaine of Han Solo. And so, I mean, it works.
I notice you're not mentioning the Ewoks. There's a lot of people here who came tonight for the Ewoks.
I think we'll have to talk about, you know, the Ewoks and imperialism and counterinsurgency later, but that seems like a subject for a follow-up question, if that's okay with you. But then it's also a franchise that really leans into popular enthusiasm for it, right? I mean, you know, you have this incredible series of spin-off books and comics and games, and, you know, in a way that really anticipates the way video games work today, it created a world that people could live in really to the extent of their interest and ability to buy and store Star Wars EU novels. So there are a terrifying number of them in my apartment. So it really, I think Star Wars was constructed to let people live in it however they wanted and for as long as they wanted. And it really anticipated the way that something like Marvel is spinning out its, you know, expanded universe today, or that, you know, the Warcraft games let you live in them forever. It really anticipated that need, I think.
Great. Thank you. Sonny, what was the first time you encountered Star Wars? Do you remember? And what do you find so special about it?
Yeah, no, I came to the series a little oddly, actually. I did not see a Star Wars movie until I was about 10, and it was Return of the Jedi. So I saw them kind of out of order, and then in order, and then with all the prequels. But it was definitely so I saw Return of the Jedi, and I had literally no idea what was going on, even more so than people sitting down to watch, you know, A New Hope for the first time. And I was still entranced. I, like, made my friend turn it back on. I was like, no, can we watch that again? I don't want to watch
So were
G.I.
you
Joe
watching
or,
it on, like, a VCR?
VHS, yeah. So it was 91 or 92 or so. VHS. On like a VHS that was recorded from TV, I believe. It was not a.
It's the ads.
It was not a home.
So what was it that captivated you and made you, okay, let's watch this again and again and again?
You know, watching it as a child, you have monsters and you have lasers and you have a very basic but interesting story. Now, granted that, again, seeing it out of order, the kind of Han, Luke, Leia triangle didn't make very much sense to me, but I was like, yeah, no, people love each other.
It does,
sure.
It makes even less sense once you go through puberty.
Yeah.
As well,
yeah. So that was my first experience.
All right. Peter, what about you? What do you think is the special sauce that keeps Star Wars front and center, really, as a way, as a text that we're still talking about?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things that both Sonny and Alyssa already touched on. In particular, this idea of a wider world. And Star Wars really sold the idea, especially the first one, the episode 4, which was just, you know, A New Hope, which is was when it was released, just Star Wars, and for years was known as just Star Wars. When you said Star Wars, that's what you were referring to. If you go back and you watch the first 30 minutes of that movie, almost every line and certainly every sort of major exchange of dialogue references something else that never comes back. You hear about power converters at Tosche Station. You hear about a droid needing to learn to speak bocce, right? And like, this is all stuff that is just, you're like, what? What is bocce? What's the binary language of humidifiers? I forget what it is, right? Like, all of this stuff that you've got to, like, it sells this idea that all of this is happening in some larger world that you can experience, and then that world, that world was expanded upon, in a lot of ways with the expanded universe, but it is a world that you can instantly imagine and sort of, you enter into, like, flights of sort of imaginative fancy, especially if you are, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10 years old, so, you know, the target audience for those films, the kids who made those movies, and that movie in particular, really a huge hit. And so I think that that's a big part of it. And then the other thing that I would say is that, visually, it's incredibly compelling. I went back and I watched the original trilogy. Yes, the special edition, it's the only thing you can get. But most of the shots in that movie, in the special edition, are relatively unaltered. The compositions are basically the same. And the compositions in that film are really incredible and really striking. You have all of these, stark black and white compositions. You have, these little tiny spaceships framed against these huge, huge, sort of galactic panoramas. You have, stuff that is like, all the stuff on Tatooine in the beginning of that film is like kind of in conversation with Lawrence of Arabia, right? It is really funny, right? But it's true. You've got C-3PO like wandering over these dunes, and it's sort of sad, and like, where's, it's cinematically, it's really brilliantly crafted. I mean, in some ways it is kind of crap, but like like you said, sort of, in story, in terms of story, and certainly in terms of like the dialogue.
Well, and also just to follow up on the idea of Star Wars being, scenes of it being in dialogue with Lawrence of Arabia, which is certainly the case. I can remember, how many of you remembered seeing the first Star Wars movie in the theater? Anybody else here? Waiting out, for hours online, hoping you could get a ticket, and then you would wait for the next show. But those shots of like the spaceships kind of slowly cruising by, and it was in conversation with 2001 Space Odyssey, but it was enjoyable. 2001 Space Odyssey is the kind of, it's like an art house movie, you know, that was big, but you have to pretend to enjoy it.
When this Star Wars came out, Space Odyssey was the biggest science fiction film that had ever been released, and it had made, I don't know, 10, 20, 30, I mean, typically science fiction films at the time would bring in $15 to $20 million at the box office. Star Wars, you know, finished its run after almost a year with about $240 million
and this
in
was
box
at
office in '70s dollars. You
a
know,
low ebb when science fiction was popular, but it was a subculture. Star Wars had vanished, or rather, Star Trek, and was being kept alive by a remnant that were writing fan fiction and buying, you know, off-brand kind of authorized editions of things. Alyssa, you were going to say something.
Well, I wanted to follow up on things that both of you were saying. I mean, and I should note, Star Wars was my gateway, not just to science fiction, but to pop culture. I grew up in a house that for a long time didn't have a television and I was basically raised Amish to a certain extent. And so my cousin showed me the Star Wars movies and sort of introduced me to the whole world. But I think that one thing that underlines what all three of us are saying is that the Star Wars movies are actually pretty smart. They demand a fair amount, even from a youthful audience. They are comprehensible, but you have to work at it and think about it a little bit. There are a lot of pre-existing concepts. It's a big universe. And so, you know, the plot requires a certain amount of political sophistication. It requires a certain amount of anthropological sophistication. It works on a number of levels. You can watch the movies when you're 10 and enjoy the funny robots and the monsters, and then you can watch them once you've been exposed to the canon of, you know, Jeeves and P.G. Woodhouse and find C-3PO funny in the
entire... And Triumph of the Will, ultimately, in Return of the Jedi. I mean, literally... Right. The final scene is a shot-for-shot remake of certain elements of Triumph of the Will.
Yes.
Well, kind of on this line, you know, the reason Star Wars has reached, a much broader audience than Star Trek has is you can enjoy it on both the shallow plot adventure level and also, like, dig down into the kind of, like, nerdy, what is the name of the bartender at Mos Eisley level, you know? Like, so,
have you read
Tales
from the Mos Eisley Cantina? It's amazing.
Is that EU? That doesn't exist anymore.
Peter. Well, let's to follow up on this, and I'm going to ask Peter this to lead the conversation on this. So, I mean, we've kind of started talking about how Star Wars isn't just phenomenally long-lived and successful as a movie franchise. It's changed how movies were financed, creative control for these big budget projects were maintained, fans were engaged, spin-off products were licensed and distributed. Lucas here is less a storyteller and more the creator of a kind of whole new universe, and not just the storytelling universe, but things you could buy. I mean, it's like the Catholic Church of movies, where you could go out and buy scapulas, you know, that the Jedi might have worn somewhere. Peter, talk a little bit about what do you think are the most important aspects of Lucas's legacy and how he changed the movie business and other related areas of creative expression?
I mean, as you mentioned, a bunch of them, and there are so many. Just a couple that I will name. Special effects. The movie was really the first film to extensively use computers to do special effects, not in generating the images, but in controlling the cameras. ILM was founded basically.
Spell it out for people.
Industrial Light and Magic, which is the special effects house that is owned by George Lucas and did the special effects for Star Wars, and is now one of, if not the premier special effects houses in Hollywood.
Was it part of the deal with Disney?
Did it sold to Disney?
I don't think so, actually, but I'm not
don't,
sure.
I don't believe so, no. But I don't want to swear to that. Fact check me, someone. So the special effects is one component. Lucas really paved the way for independent creators and for creative control over product, for individual creative control over products in film. People think of Lucas, you know, funny enough, as kind of... taking us out of the era of independent film, you know, sort of driven by creators who just had their own vision. But in fact, he was very much of that era. And one of the big things that he fought for when he was when he was doing the contracts and when he was getting Star Wars started was to own the rights to not just to the movie, but to the sort of the rest of the universe, to have all of the toy and product and, you know, and ancillary rights and all of that. And then when Empire and Return of the Jedi came out, he self-financed both of those.
based using the profits from and the loans he was able to get based on the sales from the first and then the second film. And so that was a big deal and really kind of built out the market for independent filmmaking that was all that is either only somewhat supported or entirely independent of the studio system. That didn't exist at the time.
So in a way, I mean, he's more of a auteur isn't quite the technically the right term, but he's more of a cultural impresario or a serious artist than somebody like, say, like Terrence Malick. Or, you know, other you know, people who get held up from the kind of 70s, you know, maverick movie business of like, I've got my unique vision and I'm not going to compromise. Or even Woody Allen is kind of like this. But, you know, where it's Lucas, and you don't think of him first and foremost as an artist who demands absolute creative control.
But he really did. And if you go back and watch the original Star Wars, it's bizarre. It's totally weird. You've got all these talking robots, and you've got all these strange aliens, and there was nothing like this out at the time. It wasn't. Now it feels so normal to us because, A, we've all seen that movie 100 times. I've seen that movie at least 100 times. And every movie since then is in some ways indebted to Star Wars, but it was really unusual at the time. And in fact, went over budget. The board of the studio that was helping to finance the first film really didn't believe in it, and only the CEO of Fox kind of had to protect him, and at one point had to say, you guys have to shut down filming by this Friday because I have a board meeting over the weekend. And you will not, like, at that point, I have to walk into the board meeting and say, we are not filming anymore. So whatever it is you do, just finish it by Friday. It was like, he had like 3 days at
Alyssa,
that point.
Alyssa, you were about to say something?
But part of what's interesting about this reputation for Lucas as an auteur is the way the expanded universe worked, right? Mm-hmm. Because these are, and people laugh about these novels, but they kept the franchise alive for, you know, years in between movies. And Lucas did what in some ways is an amazingly generous thing, and he let other authors come in and play in his universe. And some of these book series are really fun. The Thrawn trilogy, which, you know, posits this sort of half-alien imperial general who is this, you know, kind of military genius, is really fun and interesting and gets at a lot of the racial politics of the Empire. The Rogue Squadron books by Michael Stackpole, who's primarily a video game writer, are a really fun series of sort of commando novels that get you deep into the economics of the Empire and that have a great, you know, female anti-hero who's a really fascinating character. And so, you know, yes, Lucas is this uncompromising auteur in a lot of ways, but there's a generous legacy to that as well.
And it's kind of an open source universe in the sense that at first when fans started creating,
yes,
you know, kind of taking mass-produced goods and refashioning them to their own ideas, he at first was kind of pushing back. Then he was like, wait, this is going to help build the audience.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the models for, you know, these sort of more open universes and for these creative dialogues within mm-hmm. these properties. I mean, I think if you look at something like the Marvel Universe today, there is this sense that different creative voices can be harmonized not just into a single sort of vision of a creative universe, but into a large ongoing story that can be sort of reconciled to itself.
Yeah.
And that's produced some really exciting things. How many people here have watched some or all of Jessica Jones? You know, that's a Marvel series that's really strikingly different in tone and theme and character from everything else, but fortunately, they've had the confidence that it can be done, I think, in part because of something like the Expanded Universe.
Sonny?
Yeah, what's interesting kind of about Star Wars' relationship with intellectual property, right, is that, like, on the one hand, Lucasfilm is very protective of their brand. If you try to sell, like, knockoff Luke Skywalkers, they will put you in a dumpster and light it on fire and then sue you. But on the other hand, you know, they also... There's also a like subculture of people who make their own stormtrooper uniforms, mm-hmm. the 501st Battalion, and Lucasfilm is totally into that. They're like, go ahead, go for it. You know, they don't like it when people sell the uniforms, but if people are out there making their own stuff and, you know, going to charity events, they like it so much that George Lucas asked them to come out and like march with Darth Vader at the Rose Bowl parade a few years back. And I mean, it's like it's.
And he even judges, or he has judged fan film competitions and things like that.
So I mean, it's a kind of a it's a very weirdly split, you know, like if you're having fun, go for it. If you're making a profit, we should probably have a chat with
which
our
Which is also kind of like the Grateful Dead had this experience where they were very interested. You know, they exhorted people to kind of tape and trade shows and various kinds of tchotchkes, memorabilia. You're not supposed to make money off it, but, you know, and it seems like a pretty good compromise, actually.
I recall one of the very first videos I ever watched on the internet was in probably 97 or 98, was a short film called, I believe, Droids, in which it was basically a cops parody featuring featuring stormtroopers who were like hassling Jawas, you know, basically, and it was sort of like, no, you guys, you're
bad
gonna
droids,
come here,
bad
come
droids,
here,
what you're gonna do,
right? And it was, and this was the sort, this is the sort of wonderful thing that a movie like that, that a movie with all of these kind of extraneous ideas and this big world built into it can generate, especially when you do what Lucas did and allow the fans to participate and be part of the creative culture behind the world.
Although they were not powerful enough to get the Star Wars kid in the new trilogy, sadly. But well, let's
for
go to you know, now we're in Washington D.C. I hope nobody here has had so much to drink they don't remember that. But you know, whatever else we might say about the Star Wars series, the six movies. And I am probably, or quite possibly, the only person in this room who actually prefers the second three movies to the first three. But whatever else you might say about it, the six Star Wars movies are also explicitly political stories. They tell the story of youthful rebellion against a senescent repressive empire. Sonny, you have written about why the destruction of Alderaan, an entire planet of people, you know, they're just flying kites. It's like, you know, pre-invasion Iraq in the first movie was totally justified. And it's a given, if you follow these things, that what is called neoconservative Twitter loves the Galactic Empire.
Yeah.
Bill Kristol, the founder and editor of the Weekly Standard, has even asked what's so bad about the Empire. And one of his staffers over a dozen years ago, Jonathan Last, literally made the case for the Empire years ago. So. Now, most fans disagree with that. They're on the side of the rebels. But, you know, where and why are they wrong?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say the six Star Wars movies tell the story of a youthful rebellion against this aging empire. And that's actually not true. That's what that's what New Hope through Return of the Jedi tells.
Certainly,
If you go back and look at episode 1 through 3, it tells a very different story, right? It tells the story of kind of a
Republic becomes an empire.
Non-functioning, Republican name only, you know, ridiculous situation where member states are being blockaded by trade federations and nobody can really get anything done in the Senate. And, you know, you've got...
But wait, gridlock is good, right? At the Washington Free Beacon, you're not saying, oh, you know, we should have more laws being passed?
Well, it depends on who the emperor is.
Okay. Okay, so what are the politics of Star Wars then? Or do they tell a story that's meaningful to contemporary America or the contemporary world?
I don't know if they tell a story that is meaningful to the contemporary. I mean, it's so scattershot and ridiculous, right? Like, on the one hand, you have the kind of you have the evil empire, which have been kind of cast as Nazis, and you know and then you have the
and that's
rebellion.
In the first three movies for sure. That's Darth, you know, Darth Vader is Adolf Hitler.
Well, I would say more Grand Moff Tarkin is really Adolf Hitler. Yeah. It depends on how you want to.
Okay.
But the
daring.
The series has always been kind of. Split on this, right? Like, Americans have always kind of envisioned themselves as the rebels fighting against the evil empire, but if you look at Return of the Jedi, that's kind of consciously modeled after the Ewoks being essentially Viet Cong, taking down the, you know, mechanized, evil, destructive
America.
I mean, it's,
they're the Viet Cong.
But you know, and it's so like I trying to create a sort of sensible political idea out of this is a fool's errand. And this is why you can do things like write a defense of the destruction of Alderaan.
Right. And what is that in one sentence?
Sure.
Is it they had it coming, or?
Well, it takes more than one sentence, but I would say it's a financial and intellectual hub of a space terrorist organization trying to...
That's hiding behind its disarmament. I mean, right. Let's be clear. I assigned Sunny this piece, so I bear much of the blame for all of this.
Right. And, I mean, look.
So we have Princess Leia, the only nest reason, of Sith on this very stage right here.
The only reason we have to believe that Alderaan is a peaceful planet is because Princess Leia says so. Uh-huh. But Princess Leia does nothing but lie in that first movie.
Yeah, yeah.
She lies about the diplomatic mission she was on. Spy mission.
Yeah.
Spy mission. She lies about knowing where the Death Star plans are. She knew exactly where they
are. Do you want to take a shot at her hairstyle, too?
She has a terrible hairstyle.
Seems to have a real attitude.
She has an awful dress.
Doesn't return your calls, you know?
Whoa. Hey. Yeah. That's okay. Personal. That's, I don't want to address that here.
So, Alyssa, do you think, is there a coherent, maybe not a coherent politics to Star Wars, but is something going on there that is also interesting? Contemporary audiences.
I mean, I think that, again, one of the reasons that Star Wars is so persistent is that it's a broad schema that you can apply to many different situations, right? I think it's distinct from pop culture that is directly and obviously commenting on real-world analogs, but it is a tool that you can use to analyze all sorts of different debates. I mean, we see Star Wars commentary popping up among the Republican presidential candidates, and that's being... treated as a form of political signaling about how fond people are of sort of authoritarian styles of governing, right? I don't actually think that it is a litmus test for, where any Republican candidates stand on foreign policy, although I would really love to hear Donald Trump talk about where he fits into all of this. But it's
no job on no one.
Yeah, those Gungans. They're bringing drugs.
They're losers.
Some of them.
They're losers. Make
some of them,
radio.
I guess, are good people.
But it has lasted because it's a schema, not because it's direct commentary.
Right. Peter, what do you have? Anything
take a side in the Empire. Versus Rebels debate. I mean, that's like, are you pro Assad or are you pro ISIS? You, as the libertarian in the room, I feel like you don't have to take a side. And in fact, I think that the fact that Han Solo and to a lesser extent Boba Fett, who are two kind of independent characters who, yes, align with both sides, but in a lot of ways exist outside of the main conflict between the rebellion and the Empire and kind of have their own agendas, the fact that they have been such popular and enduring characters shows in some ways sort of the shows the appeal of kind of the independent stand outside of this conflict, don't want to be a part of it kind of ethos. And Han Solo represents that pretty well, and in his own way, so does Boba Fett, right?
This is where, to go back to earlier points I think that all of you made in different ways, this is where Star Wars is in conversation with previous pop culture, particularly that baby boomers grew up with. You mentioned Han Solo as Rick Blaine.
Yes.
I mean, he is Humphrey Bogart. Rick Blaine is the main character in Casablanca, and he's done. He has no ideals anymore, but he always ends up making the right moment. He'll be altruistic for the right cause.
Well, and one thing I think is fascinating about Star Wars, J.J. Abrams has remarked that he made the main character in The Force Awakens, the forthcoming Star Wars movie, a woman because he wanted to sort of engage female audiences. And I sympathize with that to a certain extent, but the idea that Star Wars hasn't always been a franchise for and about women is a little ridiculous, in part because it is effectively a romance novel, right? I mean, this is the standard template of a great female character who has to decide between two sort of equally worthy but different male love interests, one of whom is eliminated because he turns out to be her brother. Okay, fine.
Hey, not if libertarians get control. It'll still be on the table.
Yeah, it's a little bit judgy.
But, Han Solo's whole arc is that his principles are restored to him and he becomes a better, principled, more emotionally open person because he loves Princess Leia, right? I mean, she restores not just his sense of connection to other people, but his sense of purpose to him. I mean, it's a remarkably sophisticated grown-up romance, and it's a great romantic movie, or a great.
It could be an Apatow comedy.
You know, she's not going to get
Han's
knocked
gotta grow up.
Up.
Yeah. I thought J.J. Abrams' comments were totally bizarre. Like, I've never met a woman who liked, like, action movies generally who doesn't like Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like, the idea that women aren't into it is. I don't know, maybe, but this might be just be me mansplaining. I don't know.
No, I mean, I think it's really bizarre. Vulture has a video out today that's like all of the lines by women other than Princess Leia that are spoken in Star Wars. There are not many lines spoken by people outside of the core three or four characters in the movie. It's a remarkably focused, you know, character study through the first three movies of the franchise. You know, you have your side players, but it's a weird sort of retroactive rewriting of the movies as sexist that never really makes sense to me, especially since the leader of the rebellion is a woman. I'm sorry. Like,
it's also true in the second trilogy. I mean, Natalie Portman, the queen, is all over the place, too, as well. I mean, again,
yeah,
like, really the central character in many ways.
Yes, and she basically dies of sadness during childbirth,
sure.
Which is...
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Lucky her.
Is that it?
Well, I mean, if she had to... can you imagine being Darth Vader's wife? I mean, I'm sorry. He would be impossible.
Yeah, he's a good earner. He could do worse.
Can you imagine him coming home and be like...
He's a striver.
I bet you could have a pretty nice apartment on Coruscant.
Are you looking forward to The Force Awakens? Do you think it'll be a good movie and why?
I think it will probably be an entertaining film because J.J. Abrams tends to make entertaining films.
It has to be good, because if it is not, I will take to my bed for the next 6 months.
Peter?
Yes, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm hopeful it's good.
Wow. Okay. Well, I want to thank our participants, and thank you for coming. From Reason, thank you.